With me now on Fresh Air is James Kirkwood, who's probably best known as the co-author of the script for A Chorus Line, for which he received a Pulitzer Prize and a Tony Award. He also wrote the play P.S. Your Cat Is Dead, which on Broadway starred Cara Delevingne and Tony Musante. The play was based on his novel of the same name. Kirkwood has a long string of credits as a writer and as a performer. He's performed in musicals and acted in soap operas, and he used to be half of a comedy nightclub act. James Kirkwood has written a new novel. This novel is called Hit Me with a Rainbow. It's a story about love and miracles, and it's published by Delacorte Press. James Kirkwood, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's good to be here. How dare the president take 12 minutes out of our interview? I mean, for such trivial matters. I'm only joking.
That's right. You had to say that.
Yes.
Well, I want to get to some of your more recent work in a few minutes, but I'd like to ask you a little bit about A Chorus Line, since that's been playing in a touring company in Philadelphia.
Right.
How attached do you feel to that now? It's gone through so many different productions. It's.
You still feel, I don't know, it's a strange feeling. Sometimes I get homesick for the times that we were actually working on it, actively working on it originally. Sometimes when I have an apartment in New York near the Schubert Theater, and every once in a while I walk by, pardon me, and I go inside and I see 15 or 20 minutes, and I get a very kind of poignant homesick feeling of I wish that we were all working on something actively, because after it's opened and after you're removed from it, it's almost like a postpartum depression. I think it's like a woman after she's had the child, you know? And your direct communication with it is cut off a little, and you feel a little lost without the active participation. But I still get a real thrill watching them perform. You know, the adrenaline and the energy up on that stage always makes the little hairs on your back or spine or your arms raise up when I go into the theater.
Can you go in any time? Do you have to convince them that you are, in fact, James Kirkwood, the co-author of the show?
Sometimes I do, yeah. Sometimes I go and there's a new doorman or something. He says, well, hold on, wait a minute, you count. There's a performance going on. And I say, I'm one of the authors. And then they always let you in, you know.
Oh, maybe I'll try that. How did the story come to be for that? The story the part you did.
Michael Bennett had kind of a rap session with a lot of dancers to see if there was the content and kind of the weight of material to go into a musical about why dancers go on and why they, you know, how they can withstand this constant rejection of auditions and always going around with their hand out for a job. And then when he decided that there was a lot of material and interesting anecdotes and characters, he assembled this group, Marvin Hamlisch to write the music, Ed Kleber and the lyrics, Nick Dante and me to do the book. And then we just, I think because we had all been performers, we had a terrific empathy for the plight of performers. We had all been up on that line. We had all been forced to compete for jobs. And competition is kind of the name of the game in America, isn't it? I mean, people are taught to compete at a very early and young level. And I don't much like the fact that we have to compete, but it seems to be what we have to do. And it's tough, especially, I think, for performers, because they have to do it constantly. People in other jobs may not have a terribly good time of it, and they may get fired, but that happens every maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and some people stay in jobs for 10, 15, 20 years. But performers know. I mean, even when they're working, they can see the end of that job in sight. And I think it's a tough life.
What are some of the humorous lines that you wrote for A Chorus Line that you feel really wear well?
I remember toward the end of the show, of the show itself, Michael said, "Gee, write a funny line for Kelly Bishop, who played Sheila in the original company, the one that's a little over the hill and sees her days numbered as a chorus cutie." And so I thought, "Gee, I really don't write jokes per se, but I'll try to write a funny line." So, in what we call in the scene after the accident, which they all when they all talk about why they're in the business and are they going to go on and what they would do if they weren't in the business, I finally had Tommy Walsh, who played Bobby, suddenly spin around and look at everybody and say, okay, supposing that you can no longer dance, and you're no longer going to be in a theater. What do you want to be when you grow up? And I thought, young. So I give that line to Kelly, because she would want to be young. What are you going to be when you grow up? Young. Well, it's not really a joke, but coming from her, it became a very funny line. And I never forget the first time that it was done in preview. Marvin Hamlisch and I think Michael said, gee, that's not really a funny line. Is that a funny line? I said, well, in the context of what's going on and given her delivery, I think it is. So I waited all night, you know, about an hour and 40 minutes until Bobby finally spun around and said, all right, supposing we know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And she had impeccable timing. She just looked him right in the eye and she said, young. And it got a little laugh. And then it got a little bigger laugh. And then it got into a great big roar, and then it got applause. And I remember feeling so happy about that. And I looked down the line at all these people that said, well, it's not really a joke. And they all went, well, okay, and gave me the, you know, finger sign, the good finger sign. Commit suicide in Buffalo is redundant. That line tickles me, although I happen to like Buffalo.
But I used to live in Buffalo. You can imagine how I felt when I heard that. if the audience hadn't laughed when she said young, would you have said, well, look, you know, it's a stupid audience night, their reactions have been slow, give it a chance, tomorrow night's audience is going to be a lot smarter.
I would have said, well, give it a couple of more times. And you tend to do that, you know. And then if it doesn't work, you take it out.
Are audiences as different as I'm told they are?
Yes, they are. But the things that really work still kind of work, but it's all relative. I mean, audiences now seeing the show, there don't tend to be standing ovations now because everybody knows that the show's what it is and how long it's been there, you know. But the things that get laughs still get laughs. And the things that are poignant and touching, like Paul's monologue, the whole thing about having been in a drag show, that still gets silence and a huge hand at the end. And the finale when they all come forward in their costumes and do that, you know, marvelous last dance number still gets, and the adolescent, you know, love number still gets its applause. So it's all relative. But audiences can be quite different, you know.
Actors can be quite different too.
Oh, yeah.
And there's been a lot of different casts touring the production and doing it on Broadway and doing it in different cities. You've probably seen different people
right.
in the roles. How dependent is the way it comes across on the people who are doing it?
Well, it's amazing. It changes, but it's like a seesaw. It may go down a little on this side, and then it comes up on this side. And what you lose on the bananas, you make up on the peanuts. It's just, and amazingly enough, it always seems to work. You know, somebody may not be quite as good in this part, and then you'll see somebody in this part just be terrific, a part that you never thought could be done better than so-and-so, and suddenly you're seeing it done. So it all kind of balances out. Also, with that many people who are principals, like 16, and a cast of 28, you have that average, where if you just had two leads and one of them was a little off one night, you'd be in big trouble.
You're the kind of author who likes to be around in the front row, the third row when rehearsals are starting, to either suggest line readings to the actors or to help make changes if changes seem necessary.
Yeah, I think it's better not to be there right from the beginning. I think you should let them have their time with the director to get it on its feet, because it's inhibiting for actors and a director to have the author there right from the word go, because they have got to stumble and make mistakes and find themselves. And then when they start having run-throughs and they know the lines, and then it's time to come in, I think, and maybe suggest line readings or cuts or changes or rewrites.
Sybil Shepherd said on the show about a week ago that she's been in movies where she just couldn't deal with what the writer had written.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically unspeakable, and she had to rewrite it.
Right.
And on one of the movies, everybody rewrote their parts.
Yeah.
Did that ever happen to you that an actor says, look, you know, the meaning's all right, but I just can't speak it the way it's written and it's got to be done over?
Yeah, very, very seldom, though, because I think mainly because I was an actor for many years before I became a writer. And I think if I have anything, I have a very good sense of what dialogue can be spoken and what can't be. And a lot of dialogue that I had when I was an actor looked fine on the page, but when you started saying it, you said, no, people would not talk like that. It's not natural to speak like that. And I think that I don't mean to pat myself on the back, he said, really giving himself a thump on the back, but dialogue comes easiest to me, and I enjoy writing it. And I try not to write things that are too excessively literary so that audiences would be stopped by them or they would be problems for actors to say. Only a couple of times have I had an actor say that he couldn't say a certain speech or that was clumsy, and then you accommodate them, you know.
I think one of the problems some writers have is that all their characters speak like they do. Do you try to picture the way someone would say it once you've figured out what their character is so that you can write good dialogue for them?
Yeah, I try to get into, like in Hit Me with a Rainbow, for instance, I have never written that much using a woman's voice. And Maggie Banner, the movie star in Hit Me with a Rainbow, has a lot of dialogue. And as a matter of fact, a couple of arias or long monologues. And I thought, because I had written mostly in the first person in There Must Be a Pony and Good Times, Bad Times and P.S. Your Cat is Dead, in the male voice, that was comfortable for me, and I might have a problem with Maggie in Hit Me with a Rainbow. But not at all. Once I got into her character, then I made myself Maggie Banner when she was talking. And I felt very much at home with her voice.
What were things that made her voice a woman's voice, or that made her thoughts a woman's thought when you were devising this?
Well, I tried to deal with her sexuality from a woman's point of view, what I would imagine a woman's point of view would be, in that she certainly is a liberated woman, so there was no problem with that. She's also a candid lady, and she's also warm and mellow, and has aged well. And so I just thought of people that I had known. Tallulah Bankhead, whom I worked with when I was an actor. Lauren Bacall, whom I know, not terribly well, but, you know, I know her. And women like that, that have a certain charisma about them. And I tried to keep them in my mind. And then writing is really what if, or let's pretend. So I pretended that I was Maggie Banner. And I got right into her voice, and I enjoyed writing in her voice. And now I think I could write a book in the first person from a woman's point of view.
Well, after you've spent all that time trying to think like a female character,
right,
and projecting yourself into that persona, when mm-hmm. you come out of that, did you find your own sense of things changed after having empathized so much with this woman who you created?
Mm-hmm. Well, then I bounced right back to Kelly, who is the male protagonist, I made me, you know, because it's easier to make, or you become that person because you have a more direct line of communication to tell the story to the reader. So I always make myself the male protagonist. No, I kind of went right back to that voice, you know. The most difficult thing for me as a writer are descriptive passages, because they take much more delicate working out. And I like to write dialogue better. I don't mind doing descriptive passages if it's done in someone else's voice, like one of the characters is describing a place or a person or an event. That's comfortable for me. But to describe it in the third person, where I have to remove myself, is harder work for me.
The book that whose characters we're discussing is called Hit Me with a Rainbow, and it's the new novel written by my guest James Kirkwood, who you may also know as the co-author of the book For a Chorus Line. You are living on the East Coast now, which is where Broadway is as opposed to where Los Angeles and
yes.
Hollywood is. Why have you chosen East over West, given that you could be in either place?
I am not fond of Southern California. I don't mean the actual climate or the place or the hills or the beauty of it or the beach, but the business, the motion picture business. It's really La La Land, and it's a swamp to me. I don't like the business there at all. I find it very difficult for a writer. Also, writers are not treated terribly well in Hollywood. You know, they're constantly, I mean, they are not the top man. They don't have real control over their work as they do in the theater or in a novel. I mean, in Hit Me with a Rainbow, I had an editor, and I worked with one person closely. And that's a lovely private collaboration. In the Chorus Line, there were collaborators, but we all got along well because we had all been performers. And it was a tightly knit group. In California, once you turn in a screenplay, they can do anything with it. I mean, change it, get another writer. I have not had that happen to me, but I've written 5 screenplays and none of them have been made so far. And it's frustrating. And also there's a lot of inner studio politics that you are not privy to and you don't know why certain decisions are being made. And I find it a tough place. So I just, even though I was born and raised there, using the word raised loosely, it's not a favorite place of mine. I much prefer living in the East.
Your parents were both in film.
Yeah.
What kinds of stories did they tell you about the movie life? Did they try to discourage you from getting involved with it?
They didn't have to tell me stories. I saw. Yes, neither one of them wanted me to be in the theater because they had both had very, at times, illustrious careers and then at times very, you know, skittish careers. And it is a tough business. It's heartbreaking. It's mean. It's competitive. And there are great ups in it and also great lows. But then when I told them that I really wanted to be in the business and I felt that, you know, that was my choice to make, then they said, all right, you know, good luck. But I don't think they, either one of them was too pleased. My parents were divorced when I was quite young and many times married. My father was married 5 times and my mother 4. So I had many different step-parents and many different homes and many different schools and locations and places that I lived.
Everybody always tries to figure out what kind of effect it has on a child to go through a divorce or to go through 4 or 5 divorces like you did, which is what everyone tries to figure out about children who are growing up
right. Amongst
star parents,
yeah.
Famous parents.
I think that what it did for me, although I had a rather unhappy, traumatic, mixed up childhood because I was never in one place long enough or had a home long enough to really settle into it. Pardon me, but I think it made me tough inside and independent, and I think it made me grow up at an early age, and it also gave me a vast kind of reservoir of material to draw upon when I began writing. And I think if I had had a more or less normal childhood, I probably would not have become a writer.
How did that affect your desire or lack of desire for a family? Because I always wonder about how kind of continuity or lack of continuity affects
it. It made me want a family very badly when I was younger. But then when I constantly saw my homes being broken up by divorce and separation and fights and tantrums and people stalking out and leaving each other, it gave me a great respect for not hurting the person that you're in love with or the relationship that you're having. And realizing, I'm not saying that people don't have to get married anymore, shouldn't get married. Just for me, I don't want to put anyone through that. And if I do get married, it'll be something that happens that I will not be able to even think about. It'll be the only thing that I can do is get married. But so far, I've had too many doubts, and those experiences have. I love to have love affairs. I just think they're terrific, and I have them all the time. And I stop them when the balance shifts, and one is beginning to receive more pain than they are pleasure. And I don't mean I am, but it could be the other person. And I don't like to hurt people. And I think that when relationships turn sour, there's an awful lot of hurt that starts going back and forth. It's like a tennis game, you know?
Do you think that shift is inevitable?
No, but I think it often happens, you know? And it's too bad that it does. I do find that usually one person is the loved and the other person is the lover. I don't know why that is. I found that often happens. And it's too bad that whoever arranged it, probably he, that's with a capital H, who I'm going to have an awful lot of questions for when I get to wherever we're going. I don't know why it is so uneven, but it seems to be. Although I've had some beautiful love affairs.
Do you see relationships around you that have endured for decades, that have made it for a long time, that still work?
Yes, a few. And I marvel at them. And I look at them in awe. And I think they're miracles. And that's what I was actually writing about in Hit Me With a Rainbow, Miracles. When it comes to the miracles of meeting the right people at the right time. You know, did you ever really need a very good close friend and then you just happen to meet someone that you don't realize and you're not looking for it, or if you are looking for it, usually don't find it. But you just can turn in the corner and bump into somebody and knock them down and suddenly there's this marvelous relationship. I have a great, great respect for friendship. I think friendships are important as love affairs. And they tend to last a little longer sometimes because they're not complicated by jealousy. And I think jealousy is a bummer. And I don't think that we should be jealous. And I'm not saying that people should swap wives or anything like that. But I think that when people are not faithful sexually to their mate, it doesn't mean that they don't love them. I really don't believe that. I think that when we love someone, we really love them. And if people have other chemical attractions to other people, it's natural, I think. And I think people should learn to accept that. I think if I learned anything when I was very young, I learned one thing. And that was, if someone doesn't love you, there's nothing you can do about it. You cannot change yourself that much. If they don't, they don't. And you'd best get on about it and not brood over it and forget it.
You were talking a little bit about seeing a lot of tantrums in your home. Yeah. People who are celebrities and particularly actors and actresses and performers have a reputation for being very temperamental.
They are.
Yeah?
Yeah. You know why I think it's the nature of the business. There's so much pressure in this business that I think... the culmination of all that pressure has got to come out like an escape valve sometime, you know. I mean, if you're at the studio all day working on a film, filmmaking is very boring. It's an awful lot of waiting around and doing things over and over, and people make mistakes. That if you're playing a love scene, you cannot yell at the girl that you're playing because that ruins the relationship. And she could, you know, blow a speech 10, 12 times, and the lights are hot, and it's close and stuffy, and it's boring work. Then when you get home, if your girlfriend spills some wine on your sleeve, you tend to say, what the did you do that for God's sakes? You know, that steam has got to come out sometime, and I think that's why.
Do you think maybe some of the highly temperamental people are that way because they know they can get away with it because they are stars and people will cater to some of their excesses because they have to be protected from some of the difficulties of life because they have to look good tomorrow.
Sure, probably. And also a lot of people become very guarded of their privacy and selfish about their spare time. And they don't mean to be rude, I think, but they just have had such a public time of it in their working professional life that when they get to relax, they really want to relax. Maggie Bannerman in Hit Me With a Rainbow is that kind of woman. She is temperamental, but she's been through an awful lot. And now she's at a stage in her life when she wants to have a little peace and quiet and not be tormented or tortured.
And are you temperamental?
I used to be, yeah. I went to a psychiatrist for a couple of years to lose my temper. And because my father had it was something that I just took on from my father. My father used to just hit anyone that did anything wrong. And I thought, well, that's what you do, because that's what I saw. And then I finally, I hit a girl that I was going with that I loved very much. And she just said something kind of snide at a party to me once. And I hauled off and slapped her very hard. So much so that I'd lifted her right up off the floor and knocked her down. And I was so appalled and shocked that I would do that, that I went right to a psychiatrist. Well, I didn't go right. I went the next week because I thought, well, this is ridiculous. It's also causing other people that I love pain, and it's not making me. I always felt like a rat after I'd hit anyone. I didn't hit a lot of women, you know, mostly men. And so I'm amazed I didn't get killed because I would go up to anybody. Big truck driver that drove in front of me or got in the way, I'd yell at him and let him get out of the car, and I'd yell at him again. And people used to say to me, Jimmy, you're going to, somebody's going to kill you. But do you know why they didn't? When you have that kind of temper, people see it and they know they're dealing with a deranged person and they don't want to mess with you. It's not the idea that they could not have beat me up. They could have, you know, but they see that kind of badness and they know that they've got a, you know, it's like the cobra and the mongoose. They've got a terrier at them.
Did your psychiatrist do something that really helped you through that?
Yeah, yeah.
What helped?
Well, we just went back to the whole thing. You know, we went back to my father, and we went back to the results of that temper were never gratifying for me. They just caused me more remorse and pain and guilt and more anger. And then if people said I was temperamental, that upset me, you know? It was a...
No, I'm not.
No, I am. No, what do you mean? Bam! But I tend to write about volatile people usually. Maybe I'm still getting that part of me out. I could be temperamental, say, on a book tour like this. I had a day in Chicago that started at about 7:15 on a morning television show. And I just barely made every appointment. I would just be coming into a radio station when they were coming off the news, wondering if this poor guest was going to arrive on time. And I didn't get through until after a book signing party at about, 8 or 9 in the evening. And I was exhausted. And I had to go to the bathroom, too. And now, if someone had stepped on my foot at that point, would have yelled at someone, or if I had gotten a rude waitress or waiter or a cab driver, I probably would have put up a little squawk, you know. But I've lost my temper. I don't ever hit anyone anymore. I mean, that's ridiculous to go around hitting people.
Has this made you a firm believer in psychiatry?
No, I'm not a great, you know, I don't go around proselytizing for that. Now I just hit people with rainbows. Oh, God, I made the worst joke. I'm sorry I said that.
James Kirkwood is my guest, if you're just joining us. Tell us a little bit about Hit Me With a Rainbow. Tell us about the story.
Well, it's really I guess a kind of picaresque adventure love story. I wanted to write a love story that had a certain amount of suspense to it, and it's really a love story between a young man and an older woman, and it's his first love affair because of certain problems that he had in his adolescence, and it's her last affair because of certain problems she has, which I won't divulge. And they have it under a lot of pressure and tension. And she, in effect, really kidnaps him to get him away from some trouble because her insane ex-lover, who is an opera star and has mafia connections, just will not let her go. Because he cannot believe that if he loves her that much, she does not return the love, especially after they've had a beautiful love affair. He keeps replaying the good times in his mind, and he can't believe that as long as he feels that strongly about her, it's not returned. And Maggie and Kelly, the older woman and the younger man, do go away to Baja California, below Ensenada, And they do eventually have a beautiful love affair. And it's really a book about miracles, large ones and little ones. And I think I wrote it because so often I get letters from people who read my books. And friendships are important in all the books. And so many times I get very touching letters from young women and young men, college age, or sometimes older, who say, gee, the friendship between Peter and Jordan in Good Times, Bad Times was so beautiful. Do you think I will ever find a best friend like that? Or the friendship between these two people, or that two people, or this love affair was so perfect. Do you think that could ever happen to me? And I think that we all have to go through life believing that there are people for us. And there are. I mean, he did make a mixed bag of people. And sometimes you think you're not going to find them, but you do.
Well, this is interesting because as an author, you say you do, but as a person, you are just saying that you don't because you're not really much of a believer in marriage. You think that love affairs are great, but long-term relationships that last well are rare.
Are rare, yeah. But they do happen. And when they do, they're miracles too. And love affairs, I've had some just marvelous love affairs that have ended very nicely. We both have just decided, or we each have decided, well, now we've helped each other to this point and we've achieved this much pleasure and this much enjoyment, but now it looks like it might be getting a little bumpy. So instead of punishing one another, let's kind of cool it now. And it has not been heartbreak time. And as a matter of fact, there are a lot of girls that I went with in my younger years that are still very good friends of mine. I mean, we're good friends and see each other when I'm in that part of the country or, you know. And sometimes we don't because they're married and have children and just, you know, they have very busy lives.
I know that a lot of people's sense of what a good love affair is based on old movies. Because, you know, you grew up watching the movies and just daydreaming and fantasizing and wondering if and when it was going to ever happen to you. If they, if he would be as good looking as he on the screen always was, and would you ever become as good looking as she always was. And, I wonder now, as the author of the characters, if you wonder at all what kind of effect it's going to have on people's real expectations about life when you're writing things about love and miracles, and if that matters at all.
Well, see, what I try to do with Kelly, although he's certainly, you know, I imagine as an attractive young man, but he's very shy, he has a stutter, he's very inverted at the beginning of the book. And how could he ever imagine that this lady that he's seen up there on the silver screen in, you know, magnified 100 times in stereophonic sound and gloriously beautiful and everything would look at him and fall in love with him? I mean, it would never occur to him. But she does. And she sees that part of him, that chemistry that he has, that he probably never saw in himself. How many times do we see couples and we say, gee, what does she see in him? Or what does he see in her? Well, it's a chemical thing that goes on between two people. It's really very intangible.
Do you write back to your readers, the ones who...
Oh, yes, always. Yeah? Always, yeah. There was one time when I got out of... when I was so busy with the chorus line that I got about a year and a half behind. And I would have to... And when I started writing them, I would have to remind them and say, you probably don't remember writing me a letter in 1974, and now it's 1975 or 6, but you did, and I just wanted to thank you for taking the time and trouble. Oh, yeah, I think if people write you, I've started to get letters from Hit Me With a Rainbow, which is a kick, you know, because that's like the child is out in the world now and people are seeing it and writing you about it. And and I figure if people can take the time and trouble to write me, the least you can do is write back. I may be, you know, 3 or 4 weeks late or 5 or 6, but yeah, I write back almost everybody.
No, that's nice.
Yeah. Sometimes I have to say, the only times, and it really annoys me, sometimes people will write the publisher, and the publisher, whoever's in the mailroom or something, will make a mistake and take the letter out of the envelope and put it in an envelope to you and realize that the return address is not included in the letter itself, but was on the envelope. And then you don't know where to answer them.
So those of you who are listening who have written James Kirkwood, if you haven't gotten a response, see, that's why.
But you know what I usually do? If it's like in New York, I look in the I found a couple of girls that wrote me that whose letters were taken out of envelopes, and I looked them up in the New York telephone book, and they happened to be in Manhattan, and some people I have not found. But they were so surprised, you know, that I got a hold of them because I wanted to let them know that I did not mean to not reply to their letters.
Oh, that's really nice. Have you ever met people who were heroes or heroines for you just from having seen them in movies when you were younger or a teenager, young adult, and then had to deal with any discrepancies between the real person and the screen image that you still remembered?
Yeah, I think so. But they have not been usually bad experiences, like Tallulah Bankhead. You know, when I first met her, I was terrified to go and audition in front of her to play opposite her in a show called Welcome, Darlings. I took my first Valium when I had to go to her house and do an audition in her living room. I adored her. I mean, she was just a lovely, vulnerable, real soft touch, you know. Had a temper, though. I mean, we had a couple of battles, but they were resolved. But I just loved her. Martha Ray, Elaine Stritch, Imogene Coca, all those women that I worked with, I really adored. They're lovely, lovely people. And they may seem sometimes tough on the outside, like Maggie Banner is tough in the book, but she's vulnerable and soft. And most of them were such very, very lonely ladies after they got through working. I mean, their evenings, they would not let you go. If you worked with Stritch or with Martha Ray and Tallulah Bankhead, you didn't get much sleep because they wanted you to stay up all night and talk and play, and you know, and they wanted that audience. They didn't want to leave. Also, it's a great thing of coming down from a performance. You get so geared up out there in front of an audience for a couple of hours and all that applause and the laughter and everything, and then the curtain comes down, you can't just say, oh well, thank you very much, and hop into bed and turn the lights off. Your adrenaline is going. You know,
but you always figure that someone who is that well-known has to pick and choose who they're going to spend time with, because there's such a long list of people who want to have dinner with them and schmooze.
But that's the point, you see. Everyone thinks that, and so nobody does call them, and they're alone. Bette Davis now spends an awful lot of lonely evenings in Connecticut. I know this through good friends of hers. I'm not a good friend of hers. I've met her several times, and I admire her, and I know her. But I'm not a close friend of hers. But I know that she spends many, many lonely evenings. Because people would think, oh, Bette Davis, she must have 50 friends that she constantly sees, but people don't. I know my parents. You know, my mother, who was a fairly well-known actress at one time, Lila Lee, and a lot of stage work, a lot of film work, and television work. A lot of lonely, lonely evenings. Tallulah Bankhead spent a lot of lonely evenings. Martha Ray probably does right now. But, of course, people, those kind of performers tend to keep an entourage around them if they can. And that's why they do it, because they're lonely.
Well, did you enjoy being an actor when you were on stage?
Yeah, I loved the work, you see. I loved the actual performing. And that was like being in the sun when you're out on that stage in front of people and you know you have their attention. I didn't like the peripheral world of the theater. I didn't like having to go to agents, and I didn't like to have to audition, and I didn't like to have to go through all of the stuff that you had to do to get jobs, which is why writing has been a miracle and a blessing to me. And I think if I hadn't started writing, I would either have cashed in my chips by now or be in Matawan State for the criminally insane. I really do believe that.
You have some of that to deal with, because you have, you don't have auditions, but you have agents, and you have to send them drafts, and then you get the notice for the rewrite, or...
Yeah, but do you know
when you're starting out, you get a lot of rejection.
I never had... See, everything I've written has been published. I've never had a book rejected. I've never written a play that wasn't produced. I've had a play produced that wasn't a hit, you know? But I have not, luckily, somebody has been smiling down on me in my writing career, and I haven't gone through an awful lot of rejection. And it's something I can do when I want to work, I can work. I don't have to get permission from others. When I got the idea to write Hit Me with a Rainbow, I sat down and got out my yellow lined legal pads and started telling a story. And I feel about writing that I am telling a secret to a close friend. And then that's my privilege and joy and relaxation and also work and difficulty and everything. It's a mixed blessing, but I get to do it. If supposing I wanted to be in a play right now, well, what play would I be in? You know, there might not be one available, and they might say to me, no, you're not going to work for, you maybe do some television and summer stock, but you're not going to be on Broadway for another 3 years, or you're not going to work in a movie, or you're not, you know. And that's depressing and demeaning and disheartening to want to work and not be able to.
Is the nature of your friendships different now that you're a writer as opposed to an actor, because you write alone and you act in the company of a lot of people?
Well, no. I guess I'm, because I still have a gregarious side that gets aired in my personal life. You know, when I get through, like if I write 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 hours a day, then I'm a tennis nut. Then I play tennis. And I go out. I love to go to the movies. I like to go to the theater. I have a lot of close friends, which I consider myself lucky because I have them. And also, when I tour around for a book, then it's almost acting, like being on this program. You know, I'm being interviewed by you, and that side of me gets aired. Then I would not want to be living on a mountaintop all by myself, like Salinger is. You know, or I would not want to divorce myself from the. Also, you keep needing fuel to write. You keep needing to really live your life so that you experience things that later you will probably put into books. I use everything that anyone ever says in front of me that I think is amusing or touching or funny, I use.
Carry a little notebook with you?
Oh, sure. And if not, I just say, excuse me, that's terrific. I have to go write it down. I was talking to a woman in St. Thomas at a cocktail party, and I said, how long have you lived here? She said, a year. I said, where did you live before that? She said, Switzerland. She was English. And I said, Switzerland? How long did you live in Switzerland? She said, 7 years. I said, 7 years? What must it be like to live in Switzerland for 7 years? She said, my dear, living in Switzerland is like living in a convent with a bunch of crooked nuns. Well, it killed me. The line tickled me, you know. So somebody said something to me the other day. Someone asked me if I would lecture at a book and author luncheon in Pittsburgh. And this friend of mine was standing nearby, and he said, would he lecture at a book and author luncheon? If somebody painted an ear on a wall, he'd talk to it. And I said, excuse me, I have to write that down. You know, I write all kinds of things down. Things I hear in elevators, taxis, on the street, sure.
What's coming up in the future for you?
Well, I'm into another book. After I get Hit Me with a Rainbow really launched and finish this tour, then I'm into a book called I Teach Flying, which, of course, doesn't have anything to do with flying. And I'm starting on a new musical.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
What's that going to be like?
Well, it's going to take place in the Depression in the early 30s. It's going to have a lot of showgirls in it. And a lot of kind of glamour backstage and on stage to kind of, be in contradiction with the times. Like those great shows that they did, the Vanities and the Scandals and the Follies. All those kind of gorgeous, lush shows that were done when people were really having hard times out on the streets. And then they got to go into the theater and see all of this. And then there are going to be a couple of murders backstage. And it's going to be that kind of genre, that mix. And it intrigues me, and I'm really looking forward to working on it.
Who's doing the music?
A young guy by the name of Don Oliver is composing the music, and a young lyricist named David Spencer is going to do the lyrics. And they're in Lehman Engel's musical workshop in New York, which is, I think, one of the best of that kind that there is. And they're very talented. And we're all three of us, very kind of up about the project. We're just starting it, really, you know.
Oh, terrific. That's exciting. Yeah. I wish you the best with it, and I look forward to seeing it at some point. Thanks very much for being here, James Kirkwood.
Thank you.